I was asked to speak in solar differential rotation, and the first thing one ought to know about this is that it's really been known for a very, very long time that the Sun rotates. This was way back in the mid-17th century. It was first demonstrated. But the fact that it rotates differentially wasn't accepted till about 300 years later. So I'm going to start with a bit of history before I go on to what we know today, and a few definitions before that. And the question is, what do we mean by differential rotation? When we say differential rotation, we generally refer to a latitudinal variation of the rotation rate. Though, as we shall see very soon, and actually you have seen in a few of the previous talks, that the rotation rate also varies as a function of radius. And the easiest way to think about the rotation rate is that it's a zonal flow field on the Sun, as opposed to the meridional flows which goes from the equator to the pole. So I'll be talking just about, mainly about the east-west velocity field. And it's a fairly large component compared to the other flow fields on the surface of the Sun. At the equator, the rotational velocity is about 2 kilometers per second. I mean, it's slow rotation, but compared to the other fields, it's large. Now, how do we observe it? Traditionally, you use a number of tracers, mainly things like sunspots or groups of sunspots. In the 20th century, people started using Doppler shifts of lines, and more recently, we've been using solar oscillation frequencies. I promised you some history, really ancient history. So, this was mainly so that you can appreciate the wonderful things we've done over the past few years. The study of solar rotation actually dates back to the first telescopic observations, and the first recorded detection was reported by Scheiner. And he actually, considering when it was done, it was quite marvelous. I mean, he reported that the equatorial rotation period was around 27 days and that the poles are slower, and he also noted that the rotation axis of the Sun is at an angle to the ecliptic. But his results were ignored by the succeeding observers for a long time. One of the reasons being that people didn't really think of differential rotation, and the different movements of the sunspots gave them to believe that perhaps the sunspots are not a part of the Sun, so you can't use them to trace rotation. It wasn't until the 1850s and the 1860s that, thanks to people like Carrington, that differential rotation was really established as a fact. So what does the surface differential rotation look like? And I'm going to show you a fairly classic figure in this field. This is a figure from Howard, 1984, which shows the rotation rate as a function of latitude obtained by four different tracers. Now, what I've done here is given a sort of conversion between different units, because the earliest papers using tracers use microradians per second, which is probably the physicist unit. Helioseismologists use nanohertz, since we're used to frequencies of modes, but if you want to convert it to degrees per day, there it is, just to be helpful. Now, the problem, you'll see it once in the figure up there, is that different tracers, actually of written techniques, but I probably should have said tracers, yield roughly the same looking curve, but they're different in their levels, and all the difference isn't much, it's only about 20 meters per second at the equator. They're significant. I mean, look at the error bars and look at the difference. So, and what people noticed is that, for example, long-lived sunspots rotate more slowly at any latitude than short-lived ones. And what's normally done, I mean, this is as an aside, is that the rotation rate is generally parameterized as with a three-parameter fit as a function of the latitude or co-latitude in this manner. It's useful to keep this in mind for a number of different things, because deviations from this are fairly interesting. So the question was, why the disparate results? And even before we knew what the rotation rate is like inside, it was assumed that the reason different traces give different rotation rates is that they're anchored at different levels within the Sun and that there's a radial dependence of the rotation rate. And one of the earliest models, I'm not sure if this is the earliest, but okay, one of the earlier models, the model of the rotation rate inside the Sun, the most natural one, seemed to be these Taylor columns. And this gave a natural a radial dependence of the rotation rate. The problem is, we know now that this isn't a correct picture. So, what is it? And I'll give you a very short crash course in helioseismology. Yuri gave you a bit of it, and I'll just repeat it so that you know what we're talking about. Okay. First thing is that the Sun oscillates in millions of different modes. These oscillations are linear. We are very lucky in that. And the amplitudes of each mode is a few centimeters, of tens of centimeters per second, while the sound speed in the outer layers is of the order of 7 to 9 kilometers per second. All the observed modes are acoustic modes, or what we call P modes, P for pressure. And each mode is characterized by three numbers, N being the radial order of the mode, which is the number of nodes the wave has inside the Sun. L is the degree of the mode, and M the azimuthal order. L and N basically describe the radial dependence of the mode, and the angular dependence of the mode. And we generally describe the angular dependence as a spherical harmonic. I mean, the Sun is a sphere, after all. And L and M basically tell you how many node circles cross any latitude or any longitude. And of course, suppose you are familiar with spherical harmonics from studying the hydrogen atom in college, and that you know that the azimuthal order has 2L plus 1 values, going from plus L to minus L. And in the case of rotation, you could think of M defining modes going westwards or eastwards. Now, if the Sun was spherically symmetric, and I don't just mean it being a sphere, but if it didn't have a well-defined axis, then all modes with the same L and N, but different M's, would have the same frequency, because then you'd be free to choose any axis you want to. M would have no significance at all. But the Sun rotates and lifts this degeneracy, and the difference in frequency between positive M and negative M modes is related to the rotation rate in the interior. In fact, that's the equation which relates this is the data we have, the frequencies of the different modes, and that is related to the rotation rate in the interior as a function of both radius and degree with a known kernel. Now, we know the kernels from linear theory of oscillations, and they look something like this. I have drawn a few samples. This is an NF5 mode, a low-degree mode, which low-degree modes penetrate deeper into the Sun than high-degree modes. And this goes, you can see it has amplitude up to roughly here, and this is the MF1 mode. It samples pretty high latitude. If you have a higher degree mode, for example, these two show LF10 modes for two different values of the azimuthal order. You see they don't quite go deep enough. If it's even higher, it goes only to the surface. The contours are just that the kernel of the integral which relates the rotation rate to the splitting. So, and since we know this, what we do is we basically have to solve an integral equation. I mean, these are our data. This is what we get from observations. This we get from theory, and this is what I was showing you for a few modes. And this is what we try to find out from inversions. And I'm not going to... I won't spend time on explaining how we get this, because that's pretty messy anyway. The results are far more interesting than the method. Often what we do is, giving us the frequencies of all 2L plus 1 modes for a given given NL multiplet, they parameterize the frequency within that NL multiplet in terms of the central frequency and a series and series in M of some given polynomials. And this is the most common way the data are presented. And these are called A coefficients because they're represented at A, surprise, surprise. And these are generally, when people started doing this, people considered the normal polynomial, Legendre polynomials, but if you look at the more modern data sets, they use something like Clebsch-Gordan coefficients, which are polynomials related to Clebsch-Gordan coefficients because of the nice orthogonality properties, not that it matters. But I mean, you notice here that the rotation rate is related to the symmetric part of the frequency splitting here, and that corresponds to just the odd order coefficients in this expansion. So when you try to find out what the rotation rate is inside, you normally invert just the odd order coefficients. And you remember the three parameter fit I showed you about earlier, which the pre-helioseismology observers used, and that is fairly equivalent to just inverting the first three odd order coefficients of the series. So if you want the smooth part of the rotation rate, you just invert the first three coefficients and forget about the rest. What are the data sets that we have today? Enormous data sets, actually. Prior to 95, we just basically had just the BDSO, which is the Big Bear Solar Observatory set, and it had hundreds of multiplets, but very few splitting coefficients. They just had three odd-order splitting coefficients, so we could just get the smooth part of the rotation rate. Now, Gong and MDI have changed that. Even before Gong and MDI came to the scene, there were some other projects like Lowell from HAL, which gave a lot more frequencies and a lot more splitting. So the upshot is that we have a lot of data now. So we believe we can draw a much better picture of the rotation rate inside the sun that we have been able to till now. So what is the picture inside the sun? I'm going to put the summary on this and leave it here. It's not really... and show you the results here. What Yuri and Nick earlier had told you is the contours of constant rotation are not parallel to the rotation axis. Now shown here are inversion results using MDI data from four different inversion methods. And you'll notice that the color scale indicates the rotation rate, so the contours are there for it makes it easy to see where the color scale sort of changes. And you'll notice that in all cases, the contours are not like this. Instead, they're almost radial. So this was one of the first shocks, you might say, or surprises, I don't know, to the community that the rotation rate is so very different from what was expected. Also, I should probably explain the axis. This is, I'm showing just one quadrant of the results because we consider a spherically symmetric sun. I mean, asphericity in the shape of the sun is very small. And also the structure of the kernels are such that we only see the north-south symmetric component of the rotation. So if I'm just showing you one quadrant, that's enough. And this will sort of, you can rotate it around and this way to get it. This is the equator, this is the equatorial direction and radius, and this is the axis of rotation. So these are low latitude regions and these are high latitude regions, so the radius going inward. So the highest inversion rates are towards the equator, and the highest rotation rate, and the lowest ones towards the pole. And there's this transition in this region. And below this, the sun seems to rotate almost like a rigid body. Now this dotted line corresponds to the helioseismically determined convection zone depth, which is about 713 solar radius. Now, okay, this is...
Where did that rotation center?
I beg your pardon?
The rotation center corresponds to what latitude rotation?
Here?
Yeah.
The center has rotation velocity.
The center, no, we haven't plotted this, the rotation velocity of the center here, because with this data set, it's very difficult to invert things here.
It means the uniform rotation.
Oh, the uniform rotation would be below about 0.71 solar radius.
How much is it compared
to the radius? What latitude would that be? Okay, this corresponds to somewhere here, which is something like 720 nanohertz or so. Actually, the next figure probably makes it clearer. What I'm showing in the next figure is just rotation rate at various latitudes as a function of radius. So the first figure, the first graph on the top is for the equator, then 15 degrees, 30, 45, 60, and 75. Now, there's certain things which are very clear here. One is, of course, as a function of radius in the convection zone, things are pretty uniform. But, okay, I'll come to that later. Below the convection zone, okay, the dotted lines give the 1 sigma error bar on the inversions, and at 75 degrees our results are not very reliable, because at those high latitudes our latitudinal resolution is very poor. There are very few modes which go there, goes that, and so if you look at the other latitudes here, all these sort of merge into one nice, it's roughly constant rotation rate as a function of radius here. And that is worth, yeah, about 430 something. Okay, the other thing to note is what people have been talking about earlier, is the sudden change in the rotation rate at this point. In the convection zone, you have differential rotation, and then in the radiative zone, it's almost rigid body, and there's this sharp jump in the rotation rate. And this layer is what we refer to as the Tacock line. I'll come to the Tacock line in a minute, but before that I'd like you to notice is that at the surface, there's a shear layer. The rotation rate increases inward slightly before it shows a slight decline. And I believe some simulations of solar rotation do produce this. I think Frank Robinson has a poster out there where he does get the shear layer. We haven't quite studied the shear layer very in much detail yet, though I think that will change soon, because there's a question of whether the direction of the shear changes with latitude or not. So these are the few things which is to be noticed about the rotation rate in the convection zone. Now what happens? So what's the Tacock line like? Now the problem with the Tacock line is that our inversions are not good enough to resolve the Tacock line properly. Our radial resolution is not good. So what's normally done is that you parameterize the Tacock line in some way and then try to find out the parameters of the Tacock line. Now, I beg your pardon?
What is the radial resolution?
At the convection zone base, I believe it's something like 0.1 solar radius in the half width. And that's thicker than what we see the Tacock line is.
Before you go to the next graph, why do people say that the radiative core is in fact a solid body? It looks very non-solid.
Now, I would urge you not to bother about the 75 degree inversion. It's not very reliable. And besides, you can see that within 1 sigma errors, it is still a solid body.
Doesn't look so to me.
Your aqua curve seems to defy that.
I beg your pardon?
Your 60 degree curve seems to defy that.
Well, yes, but, I mean, given the latitudinal resolution at 60 degrees at the base of the convection zone, I mean, the problem about projecting a two-dimensional function onto one dimension so that you can't really project the error bars and everything properly, so that you know that it's not inconsistent with the solid body rotation. So.
Why is the
is 75 degrees.
Oh, it's so high. I should show you the. I have those curls out here. It's only the low M kernels which sample the high latitudes. Now, there are very few low M kernels. Most of the, for any given L. So we just don't have enough information to resolve that part properly. So it's just the question, it's the limitation of the data.
How does this accord with the observation of the different sized sunspots?
The sunspots are way up here.
They're being looted at different...
But that would still be at the very outer layer here. And that is, there's the shear layer here. So there's this very sharp shear layer, which global mode analysis, the way we've done here, doesn't really resolve very well. By local methods, we have been able to resolve that much better. And it's a very sharp shear layer. So if you have nodes which are, if you have objects which are anchored, say, at different regions here, they would have a different rotation rate.
Wouldn't a bigger spot tend to be anchored lower? The
spots may be anchored in the time slot.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, for all you know, yes.
Okay. That's what I'd be asking.
Yeah. So coming back to the Tattock line, I mean, since Julian Elliott isn't going to be here, I thought I'd spend some time on the Tattock line, from what we see, if not the modeling point of view. Since we can't resolve the Tattock line properly in inversion, we parameterize it.
When you say properly as opposed to improperly, you have a certain resolution. Separately, you have an opinion that the Tattock line might be thinner.
True, but yes.
Fine.
Yes. So, sorry about the quality of this view graph, but this is a sort of last-minute addition. The way I've been going about is to assume the Tattock line has a sort of sigmoid shape. This parameterization varies from author to author, and we've been sort of trying to figure out the intercomparisons, but the Tattock line turns out to be so thin it doesn't matter. So the way I define it is that delta omega is the jump between the rotation rate in the convection zone and the rotation rate in the radiative zone. The midpoint is what I call the position of the Tattock line, that's RD. And in this parameterization, the width is the point where the rotation rate increases to about 0.73 of the maximum or decreases to about 0.26 of the maximum. It's not very symmetric, I know. I'm sorry about that.
Are those parameters all functions of
theta? I beg your pardon?
Are those parameters all functions of theta?
That's what we're trying to find out. So we take each latitude separately, and we could take the whole thing globally and parameterize them as a function of theta, but yeah, in principle. And it's one of the aims is to see whether they are indeed functions of theta. And to anticipate our results, they seem to be. Okay. So, what does RD, I'll first concentrate on the position, look like as a function of latitude, and as, in fact, this view graph shows as a function of time. Now, the orange line in each of them is the base of the convection zone as determined from helioseismic studies. So one thing to note is that the Tattock line is actually well within the stable layers of the Sun. And this has implications for mixing of elements in the radiative zone, because Tattock line is a shear layer, and it has such huge changes in rotation rate that you expect large shears there. And since they are in the radiative zone, they provide a method of mixing material in the radiative zone. Also, I'm sure for the solar dynamo people, it's a nice and stable region, so you could anchor your magnetic fields here without having them float up. The other thing to notice is, which you wouldn't believe if you had just one point, but if you look at all the points that we have, is that the Tattock line at the equator is deeper than Tattock line in the higher latitudes. I mean, it's not a very big effect, and the error bars are large, true, but if you just take all the points together, it sort of increases your significance. So I'm not sure what this means physically, but this is what we see. And what I claim from this figure is that we're not seeing too much of a time variation in the properties of the position of the diaperclon, at least. I have some more data now, which are in the process of being analyzed, that, they are as...
Any correlation with the solar cycle?
I don't see any. If I just take the first few points of the low activity plane, it does seem to be correlated with solar activity, but it sort of seems to have gone off with the rest and hasn't appeared. It's the uncertainty. Okay, I mean, there is a correlation between the uncertainties of the three parameters of the diaperclon, but that sort of assumed that the correlation is zero and calculated the thing. In this case, I mean, since the diaperclon doesn't vary with time, Russell had asked yesterday, what about the base of the convection zone? And actually, we don't see any change in that either. These are base convection zone position measurements using two different data sets between 95 and 99. And
look at the scale closely.
It's very unimpressive.
The thing here is that these are the random errors. The systematic errors are larger, but since they would be the same all over, I haven't bothered showing that scale. But
if you can comment, what do you think is the resolution with which you determine those numbers? I mean, is it error bar, or you actually have certain version kernels from which you make these inferences?
No, this is it's a combination between a forward and a inversion technique, and the resolution is actually, if I had error-free data, the resolution is much better than what I show by the error bars. So it's not limited by our resolution. You look at the sound speed differences between models with different convection zone depths. Now, the thing about the convection zone base is that there's this change in the temperature gradient there, and that changes the sound speed, and you can actually you can calibrate exactly where the sound speed changes. Yes.
But it's actually the bottom of the overshoot layer that you're really measuring, I think.
Yes, except that when we try to measure where the overshoot layer goes, I mean, with the caveat that if you assume, like what all stellar physicists do, that the overshoot layer is purely adiabatic.
Of course.
The way people model stars is the overshoot layer is adiabatic. And the extent of the adiabatic overshoot in the Sun is very, very small. The upper limits are about 0.05 pressure scale height, so which means about 2,800 kilometers, which is nothing. Okay. Now, the jump across the diaperclon doesn't change with time either. This is the jump between the rotation rates at the convection zone and below the convection zone base. And I seem to have forgotten a view graph about the width, but I have one for a given time. And you'll find that the width of the diaperclon, if you look here, these points here, is very small. It increases with latitude, but it's about the way I've parameterized it, it's about 1%, which, Paul, you were saying about 4% yesterday, but this would correspond to 4% in your parameterization, so it's consistent. So it's a very thin layer. I mean, 0.01 solar radii is what, 7 millimeters to 7,000 kilometers. It's a very thin layer. Okay.
Thin compared to the radius of the Earth?
Well, no, but we are comparing things with the radius of the Sun. The other things we know from helioseismology are that, for one thing, of course, we can measure the rotation rate at high latitudes, which wasn't possible with magnetic traces. The interesting thing is that the Sun seems to slow down at very high latitudes. By slow down, what I mean is if you make a three-parameter fit to the rotation rate as a function of latitude, and then you plot the actual rotation rate, there's a big, big deficit at high latitudes. This we're still looking at. I think this is well established by now, reasonably, that No, sorry. The red line is, these are both helioseismic measurements. The red line is a three-parameter fit to the helioseismic. A three-parameter, that is A plus B sine squared and C sine to the fourth. And the blue line is the actual measurement. And these are... Sorry?
How deep are you?
Oh, we are very close to the surface here. Yeah, this is about point, 0.87 or so. Sorry, 0.987 or so. Yeah. This is very close to the surface. And we see this big deficit there. And we're trying... at least some of us agree that it's probably real, but I suppose if we have more data, we'll know for sure. But I beg your pardon? We have a large amount of error, but I mean, the error, of course, varies as a function of depth as well as latitude. And the reason we are still a bit uncertain about it is that because we are at high latitudes. And so this error is maybe small, but the question is about what the resolution effect is here. So,
point of clarification, you said the red line is fit to the A plus B plus C term, but you also said that is originally for sunspots.
That was originally applied to sunspots, but what we try to do is, okay, we can apply that to anything else too. So we applied that.
But the A, B, and C are completely different for sunspots, right?
Yes. We fit those and see that. Though, of course, the rotation rates, it's not that we have disagreeing rotation rates or anything. But this is a curious feature which I thought people might like to know. Okay. I'll come to that in a minute, because that defines what we would call the zonal flow or the torsional oscillation. And that shows very interesting time, solar cycle related behavior. Yes. I'm not going to talk about the solar core at all, except to say that it's extremely difficult to invert. And most groups claim that the solar core is rotating slower than the surface equatorial rate. Though there's some who claim that it's much faster, though if you just take a vote, it would go to slower, which the theorists don't seem to like too well, because I believe it's difficult to have the core rotating slower than the surface. But I'll leave it at that. Now, coming to the deviations from the three-parameter fit, this is just a toy. I mean, the radiation velocity, if you just plot it against latitude, looks like this nice smooth curve. But if you subtract a three-parameter fit, what you get is what's here. And this is often referred to as either the zonal flow, or as we think it is, it's what was first detected as torsional oscillations of the sun, because this changes as a function of time.
Please excuse me, at what radius is this?
Oh, this is at NE. I'll show you the real data now. Okay, this is for a fairly recent data set and the zonal flow at different radii. Now, starting at the top is the one closest to the surface, and then we sort of increase the radius this way. And if you believe the point H results despite the error bars, then you see that these oscillations are not just along radius too, but also in depth.
That's a new result from point 8, isn't it?
Yes, but I mean, it was first seen with ring diagrams. So both Deborah and I have seen that in our results, except that we, of course, neither of us believe in point 8 at ring diagrams. With ring diagrams.
But suppose you set a fitting with your cube and you fit with a higher order polynomial cause coming down there and fit at the radius.
The reason we fit it cubic is that the torsional oscillation measurements were with the cubic term removed. So we wanted to see whether we match the torsional oscillation results. Okay. The reason I'm so excited about the zonal flows is the variation of the zonal flow with time. So what I show here is four different radii again, as a function of time, and the red shows positive amplitudes with respect to the three parameter set, and the blue shows negative amplitudes. And we see this migration towards the equator, which has been seen by other groups too. But the interesting feature we find is that if we define the mean amplitude of this flow, which the way we do it is we take the amplitude between 0 and 60 degrees and the magnitude of the amplitude between 0 and 60 degrees and plot it along with some solar activity indicator, like what we've done here is plotted with the 10.7 centimeter radial flux, then in the outer layers there seems to be a wonderful correlation between the mean amplitude and the activity. So we actually went ahead and tried to calculate the sort of correlation coefficients. And that is the red curve here as a function of radius. And you can see that in the outer layers of the sun, the correlation between the amplitude of the zonal flows and the solar activity is extremely high.
What's the blue curve?
The blue curve is if we try, instead of subtracting a three-parameter fit, we try to subtract the mean of the solar rotation rate.
Oh.
The interesting feature here is that the correlation coefficient sort of jumps steeply at that point. And we try to see if it's an effect due to errors or due to resolution effects, and that doesn't seem to produce it, so we believe it's real. And the conclusion we sort of try to draw out of it is that the zonal flows actually penetrate to this sort of depth.
And it leaves from here. 0.9?
Yeah, 0.9 or so, maybe sort of, yeah, something like that.
Can you just remind us that the delta mega plot you showed,
mm-hmm.
the difference of the helioseismic omega and...
No,
omega.
No.
Sorry.
It was the you made the heat.
I mean
no.
The original one where you said that these are important oscillations.
Okay. Now what you do is get the helioseismic omega.
Yes.
And fit that with as a function a plus b sine to the sine squared phi plus c sine to the 4 phi, a three parameter fit. And see what the residuals look like. And the residuals are what we call the zonal flows. And what this plot shows is how the residuals behave with time and with radius. And these match with what are called torsional oscillations on the sun.
So if you went to one higher order, would this all go away?
No.
A lot of it, some of it goes away, but not all.
Could I ask, is it symmetric north and south? Or
the way we do the inversions, we are forced to have symmetric north and south. By local techniques, we are able to see some north-south asymmetry, but what we find is that the north-south asymmetry is barely one sigma away from being zero, so we're still trying to see whether that's real or not.
Yeah. Could I just quickly ask, are you correlating, when you do your correlation, are you correlating delta omega?
We're correlating a mean delta omega with the with solar activity. Oh, okay, sorry. The magnitudes here are of the order of a few nanohertz. The contours are drawn at intervals of 3 nanohertz or so.
So in people units, it's more like 5 meters per second.
Yes.
They speed up and slow down.
Okay.
I've been inducted
in
10 nanohertz.
Oh, good, excuse me.
Just not per second, I can't get used to it.
Okay, I'll just put up my summary here. It's that we know solar differential rotation continues up to the base of the convection zone. In the convection zone, the quantities of constant rotation are radial, and they're not parallel to the rotation axis. Differential rotation is even seen in the higher latitudes that are inaccessible to magnetic traces. There's a very sharp transition in the rotation rate between the convection zone and the radiative zone. That's what we call the tachocline. And there is some variation, in fact, a large variation, of the rotation rate with time in the outer layers of the sun. Thank you for your attention.
Basically.
Yes, that is what we get.
Is that too far for intrinsic dynamo to work? Can't the value of overshoot reach the time
line? I don't know.
No, it's not necessary.
Okay.
But there's been claims that it's...
No, but the thing is, we replace the midpoint of at the equator, even if we consider the thickness of the Dirac line, it is below the base of the convection zone, yes.
We have to also differentiate between the region where
the
actual convection
zone is.
That
means
that.
May I just answer? Say a word.
No, please go.
With respect to that question, the nature of the instabilities that drive the dynamo depend on whether the... You really should use the word magnetocline. I apologize for this other word, because there's a magnetic layer which will drive magnetic buoyancy. And if, depending on whether you have magnetic stability versus entropic instability, or the other way, the instabilities come on as oscillations or steady. And the whole nature of the process is somewhat modified. But either way, you can sort of, since it's all arm wave,
if you can assign a magnetic frequency to the sun, the alpine, some effective alpine frequency to compare it with the period.
No, I haven't done that, and I'm not aware if anyone's done that.
What was the question?
If we can compare some sort of a magnetic frequency for the sun, an alpine frequency with the frequencies that we get here. With the frequencies that we get here, rotation frequencies. And I'm not aware if anyone's done that or even tried to.
The sound travels on times the square root of beta.
So the sound time is 20 minutes. So it's 10 times 4.
I'm not sure this is a meaningful question, but is it a value to make a vorticity and rate of strain map of the data and see where some of these gradients, you might enhance the viewpoint that way?
Well, I'm not sure people have done it with this two-dimensional function that we get from global oscillations, but we have tried to do it just at the surface, where we actually have three-dimensional information about the flows, and we got stymied by the errors. The errors are still a bit too large, but but I mean, you do see things like flows converging and flows diverging on the surface. We can detect those even without trying to differentiate things. Well, they are fairly well correlated where the sunspots are. Where the sunspots, the flows seem to decrease.
Did you show the shadow
in the It's not very well resolved in the global mode, global inversions which I showed here, except that it's clear that it's there. And but if you go into local, if you do some other inversion technique, use some other inversion techniques with other data, it's very well resolved, and we know that the rotation rate is not highest at the surface but within.
Can you comment on what's the
rotation model? We're looking into that right now. We're not sure whether it's a part of the zonal flow, independent of it, or how it changes with time and things like that. I think we'll know in 2 months' time. Our aim is to present it at a meeting in October, so let's see.
Right.